absolutely is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. Unfortunately, I've got some bad news. This is John Hancock, and I'm filling in for the next 3 hours for Mark Reardon, so I hope some of you will stick around, but I also have some good news.
Well, it's supposed to be, you're supposed to be hearing a sounder that's going to be telling you that there's good news.
Breaking news. We're breaking news is what we're doing here on the Mark Reardon Show. Tomorrow, of course, is the roundtable on Friday. And tomorrow, Jane Duker and Tim Fitch and Steve Butts are going to be in. And they're going to be in with your host, Mark Reardon. He is back tomorrow on 97.1.
I've heard of him. I mean, I have heard of him.
Haven't seen him around these parts, but it would be great to have him in tomorrow. Wow, dude, so much to talk about today. I mean, my heavens. And I've got a great story I'm going to tell later, too. I can't wait. Yeah, yeah. It's about a famous racehorse. That's all I can tell you right now.
Ooh.
That's all I can tell you right now.
Is he still living?
We don't know if he or she is still living, so we'll get there.
Okay.
But they did have some breaking news over on the east side today, over in Alton, Illinois. Tragic helicopter crash killed the pilot and co-pilot. Both died. There was an Ameren, Missouri, or Ameren, Illinois, one or the other, helicopter. To tell us about it from the newsroom over at KMOX is our own Maria Kina. What happened?
Well, we don't know what happened other than the fact, and I should make note of the fact, it's actually not, it's a contractor that was contracting with Ameren. What happened was they were doing, fixing power lines and putting up, you know, when you see those large red balls along the river there, they were doing that. And so they were essentially fixing that all along the way. And at this point, nobody knows what happened. It appears that they hit one of the wires and then crashed into the barge.
Mm.
There was a brief fire, but they extinguished that really quickly. But the two on board did not survive.
Oh, man. Really? And it landed on a barge.
On a barge. And I don't know if you've seen any of the pictures of it.
But I haven't.
This chopper is mutilated. You can't even make out it's a chopper.
Wow.
Oh, Maria. It's when did that happen?
What it happened about 11:30 this morning.
Oh, my gosh.
That's when they first received the call. And I should mention this is on the West Alton side. So technically it's in Missouri.
Oh, it was. Okay.
So it was a little bit of a difficult area to get into because it wasn't like it was just right on the Great River Road there. It's because it's on the other side of it.
Oh, gosh.
Now, Ameren did release a statement, which they sent to me just a couple of minutes ago. And it says, "We are saddened about today's tragic incident. Our thoughts and heartfelt condolences are with the victims' families and colleagues. We will cooperate with the investigation." And it goes on to say, an Ameren contractor and its subcontractor was repairing and replacing tower lighting and marker balls on the lines in Madison County, Illinois. There are no power outages associated with today's events.
Maria, how many were in the helicopter? Were there just two and they both passed?
I believe there were only two, but they haven't said that definitively.
No names have been released, I'm sure, at this point.
But there were quite a few JF electrical trucks out there. That's an electrical company that does a lot of contracting. And I called them, and she said, "We are not saying one word about this incident." So I have a feeling, just a feeling, but I have a feeling that it might be the contractor.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You just hate to see, you know, no loss of life on the ground because of the barge. Do we know what was on the barge?
No. But apparently, fire officials have said that there was nothing toxic, or at least if there were, they contained it.
Well, thank goodness, because, I mean, it would have been entirely possible, I would think, that for them to have something very flammable or toxic on a barge like that.
And for that whole barge to go up
at
the same time. I did ask St. Louis Fire Department if they responded over here, and they did to West Alton, but then they weren't needed, and they went back. But there was a huge multiple aid situation over there.
Gosh.
Wow. So that's the news that has broken today. The contractors in a helicopter for Ameren crashed and died today in East Alton, Missouri.
Yeah.
Maria Kina from the KMOX Newsroom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's kind of a downer to start the show, but it is the news and it is current. We're going to make some more news on this show today. Next hour, we're going to visit with Brian Williams, a state senator from St. Louis County, who today announced his candidacy for St. Louis County Executive. He's a Democrat, so he'll be running against Sam Page, presumably, the indicted Sam Page, presumably, in the Democratic primary, should Page choose to run. We're going to visit with him. Our own great attorney, Brad Young, is going to join us after the first break here and talk about the tariffs in the context of ongoing litigation about them. There's an effort afoot out there in the legal community on the left that is trying to suspend Trump's tariffs. And we'll find out what the arguments they're making and perhaps the likelihood of its success. I spent a little time yesterday on the show, guys, talking about this redistricting effort that's afoot in Texas. So we know the story. The Texas Democrats fled to Illinois, and they're being protected by Uncle Pritzker there. And now you're seeing states like California, New York, potentially other states, Indiana, Missouri, potentially, all talking about redrawing their congressional maps in the middle of the decennial census. It's not unprecedented, but it's been very rare, and we've really not seen anything quite like it since the late 19th century. So
wow.
it's quite rare. And I've got some concerns. I'm going to share those off the top here. While it would be great to add 5 Republican seats in Texas and maybe another Republican seat in Missouri and Indiana, those things would be great. They would give Republicans a better chance of holding the U.S. House next year. I kind of question the political judgment of doing this. And here's why. I'll just lay out a couple of things quickly here. One is that if we can do it, they can do it.
Exactly.
And if we do it, they will do it.
Yes.
And they've got potentially, I've not really studied it, but what I will tell you is I've supervised 2 redistrictings in Missouri in 2000 and 2010, and I was sort of peripherally involved in the 2020 redistricting. I was peripherally involved, for that matter, in the 1990 redistricting. So the way these things work, Sue, is that the incumbent members of Congress get together, and they put a map together that they're all kind of comfortable with. And it's kind of clubby. You know, they'll put a map together. If there's a way, if your party is in control of the legislature, because ultimately congressional maps are a bill that passes through the state legislature.
Oh.
And so the state legislature will try and take some advantage for their party if they're able to. And in bigger states, it's easier to do. And we're going to talk about what a disaster the Illinois map is with a state representative over there later in the show. Lots going on today. And that's how it typically works. And incumbent members of Congress would like their districts to be what you would call bulletproof, so that they're not really vulnerable to an opponent in the other party. So you'll draw that sucker, you know, 60%. If you're a Republican, you'll draw it 60% Republican. If you're a Democrat, you'll draw it 60 or 70% Democrats. Easier to pack Democrats together because of their densely populated areas. And you do that. Well, once you start optimizing a map for one party, which is what they're doing essentially in Texas, they're optimizing the map for Republicans, and they're going to increase 4 or maybe 5 seats from the current number, which is a lot. What you're going to have to do in order to make that happen is you've got to take those Democrat votes and disperse them among multiple different districts. And so that what invariably happens is you take a 60% Republican district down to a 52% Republican district. And there's more of them. And the theory is if it's 52%, you can win it. If it's 53%, you can win it. Well, that may be true. But the other thing we know about politics is that midterm elections, especially when one party has the White House, the U.S. House, and the U.S. Senate, midterm elections almost always go against the party in power. Almost always. Obama had 2 disastrous midterms when he was president. Trump had a disastrous midterm in his first term in 2018. And, you know, it's likely that if you make these districts too thin, that we'll lose some of them and we may not gain the ones we think we're going to gain. And if the other side, the Democrats, are playing the same game in California and New York, it's basically going to be a wash. And you've set a precedent now to redraw lines over and over and over again. And, you know, I don't particularly think that's helpful for us, for the conservative cause in this country. But we'll find out how that all plays out. Have you seen the Billy Joel documentary?
It's on my list.
You
got to
see it.
We're going to watch it. We're going to both be there. I've had times when I can watch it without him, and It's not. We have to both sit down and watch it. How great is it?
It's phenomenal, and I love Billy Joel's music.
Same.
And genius as a songwriter, but there's so much in here that I didn't know. And I interviewed three of his wives.
Wow.
His half brother that I didn't know he had.
Oh, I didn't know he had one either.
It's really fascinating. We might get to that some later today. But coming up next, it is our own Brad Young, and I'm going to talk a little tariff talk next on the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM. Back to the Mark Reardon Show here on 97.1 FM Talk. John Hancock filling in. Mark Reardon is back tomorrow, and we're very happy about that. And we're also very happy to be joined right now by our chief legal analyst here at 97.1. He's a partner with the law firm of Harris Dowell, Fisher & Young. He's our buddy. We like him. He's smart, and he's with us, Brad Young. Hey, Brad.
John, good to talk to you, my friend.
Always a pleasure. So I've been following, you know, this the drama over the whole tariff regime, really since President Trump assumed office. And he's claiming, as I understand it, he's got emergency authority to be able to negotiate and implement these tariffs with various countries. And that's the same basis he used in his first term, although much less extensively, obviously. But I'm aware that there's some legal effort going on. I presume it's from the left that are trying to restrict or cancel or change. And I thought, who can I get to talk about this? And it hit me. Brad Young. So what's happening with these tariffs, buddy?
Well, first of all, you said drama. Over these tariffs, there's more drama than you see in a Mexican soap opera. So
you ever watch those things?
I have. Oh, they're hilarious, especially when you've been drinking.
And you don't need to speak Spanish either to know what's going on. You know precisely what's happening.
I don't speak any Spanish except donde está el baño.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can follow exactly what's going on with those things. They're amazing. But in this instance, look, here's the whole thing right now in a nutshell. Up to this point, Trump has been exercising his right to control tariffs under what's called the IEEPA. It's a 1977 law, and it only specifies that in a national emergency, the president is allowed to regulate or prohibit imports. And it does not explicitly regulate or allow for tariffs, because under the Constitution, tariffs are at the sole power of Congress unless Congress delegates that power to the president. So right now, there has already been a Court of Appeals oral arguments earlier this week where the judges, not Supreme Court, but a Court of Appeals, really questioned whether the IEEPA allows Trump to do all this with tariffs because there's no emergency regarding the importation of goods and services.
Now, the president's claiming there is an emergency related to the balance of trade, right?
Well, and that raises such an amazing issue, John, and that's this. The courts don't ever want to wade into things that are what they call political issues between other branches of government. They just want to read statutes, look at what people are doing, read the Constitution, and analyze how it matches up.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the areas where I think the Supreme Court may be leery of getting into is, what is the definition of a national emergency? And so that really could be Trump's strongest card at the Supreme Court, because as I read the IEEPA, I'm not sure that it even authorizes tariffs at all. Now, there are other statutes that do. And so that brings me to my second point. And that is, you remember during the Biden administration where the courts would say, you can't forgive student loans. And then he would come back, and then he would fall back on a different law and then start forgiving student loans. And then that would get challenged. And then the court said, you can't do this student loan forgiveness under this law either. It's kind of a shell game. Well, Trump can play the same shell game with tariffs by saying if the IEEPA doesn't allow him to exercise or to impose tariffs, then he can say, well, I'm doing it under this different law. And then at that point, that would have to go up to the Supreme Court. So there is a shell game here about where the power lies, how he's exercising it, and how courts will determine whether he can or cannot exercise that power in light of the fact that Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution assigns the tariff power to Congress.
So if we get there and then somehow this thing goes all the way to the Supreme Court and they rule and they say, oops, you can't do that, then what?
Well, I don't think there would have to be any kind of refunds going on here, because when the tariffs were imposed, there was no, to quote Al Gore, no controlling legal authority, unquote, regarding whether he could or couldn't do it. But if the Supremes say under the IEEPA, you cannot impose tariffs, okay, then he says, I'm going to impose the same tariffs under a different law. Then that's going to have to go up to the Supremes. All right. So this is going to be a multi-year process.
Yeah.
It's not anything that's going to be determined anytime soon.
Would there be any advantage? I mean, while Republicans have a majority in the House and Senate, would there be any advantage? Of course, they would need 60 votes in the Senate. So, right.
Right. And therein lies the problem, because you're automatically you're going to lose Collins. You're going to lose Murkowski. And so then you're down to maybe one vote advantage. And if you get a tie, you could break it. But the only way they could have done this to give him additional power over tariffs would have been in the big, beautiful bill from a reconciliation standpoint. And this didn't come up.
Yeah. You know, and I'm old enough to remember when the tariff backers were the Democrats. Dick Gephardt back in the day, it was called protectionism. And the idea of, in Gephardt's day, was that we would impose tariffs to protect American industry and American manufacturing, which is not dissimilar from the same argument that that the Trump administration is using. So I don't know. Maybe there still are some Democrats floating around out there that think this is a good idea.
Nah, there's no Democrats. Listen, if Trump came out and issued an executive order that today is Thursday, the Democrats would say he's wrong, he's a liar, and it's fake news.
Yep, yep. You can't even like puppies at this point if he comes out for it. So, I want to turn my attention. You got a couple minutes here, so help me with this mid-cycle redistricting that's happening. Are there going to be legal grounds for what's happening in Texas and potentially California, potentially Missouri? Is it cut and dry that this is doable?
It's not been done before. And when you say midterm, generally redistricting occurs after a census.
Yep.
And so right now there hasn't been a census since 2000. And so, and depending on who you listen to, it may or may not be an accurate census because people were counted that maybe shouldn't have been. So fast forward to today. Can you do that? It's never been tried. And so there's no legal precedent here about whether you can do a mid-census redistricting or not. What I find, though, hilarious is that the governor of Massachusetts came out today and said she would be in favor of doing additional redistricting in Massachusetts in light of what Texas is doing. However, when I looked at the map, there is not a single Republican district in Massachusetts because they've already gerrymandered all the Republicans away.
Well, and
I don't know what she would be doing.
I'm a little surprised, you know, just between us, that Texas has got four or five seats to pick up at, because, I mean, they control everything there.
Yeah, they do. And when you look at the restrictions, and that's probably going to be your next question here, is what under the law can or can't happen under redistricting. Under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause and under the Voting Rights Act of 1965, race cannot be a basis for redistricting.
Right.
But political concerns can be, and there's no better proof of that than looking at the district map of Illinois, which is, of course, governed by His Honor Commissar Pritzker.
Yeah.
And under that, I mean, it's all gerrymandered over in Illinois.
That may be the worst.
On political.
That may be the worst I've ever seen. The
Illinois it's map. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, one district goes from like Belleville to South St. Louis or South Chicago. And there's no reason to do that other than to make sure that the Democrats control the state. Listen, we can all agree that redistricting is something that Republicans and Democrats do primarily in states where they have a supermajority. Red states do it. Blue states do
Absolutely.
It. But the question is, can you do it in between a census? And that is the million-dollar question.
Indeed, it is a million-dollar question. And we appreciate your free answer to that million-dollar question.
Brad Young. Worth everything you paid for it.
Yeah,
worth everything you paid for.
It's always good stuff from you, Brad Young. That's Brad Young with the law firm of Harris, Dow, Fisher & Young. Hey, have you seen the Billy Joel documentary?
I've not yet seen it,
but it's
on my watch list.
Watch it.
Gotta
5 hours, but watch it. It's really good. Especially if you're into his music.
I am, and I will enjoy it, my friend.
All right, when we come back, Jim Carafano, Senior Foreign Policy Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, talk about this potential meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin as early as next week. That's next on the Mark Reardon Show, 97.1 FM Talk. And welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. John Hancock filling in for Mark. But the good news for all of you is that Mark Reardon is back tomorrow. And he'll be with you. He'll have his Reardon Roundtable. It'll be good to hear that voice again. And we are joined right now by a great guest of the show, a good friend of the show, Jim Carafano. He's the Senior Foreign Policy Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Jim, Secretary of State Marco Rubio had this to say earlier today.
I think what all sides would like to see is if we can make enough progress, we'll have a meeting. And I think it'll take that kind of meeting to bring this thing to an end.
Talking about a meeting between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Let's start here. Is this likely to happen? And is it likely to happen in, within the next week or two?
Well, if it doesn't happen in the next week or two, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. We don't know, quite honestly, if Putin is still practicing rope-a-dope or if he is ready to just give up and make the deal that Trump had offered him all along, which is just a straight-out ceasefire. And I think we'll know this pretty soon. I can argue both parts of this. On the one hand, there are some signs that maybe Putin finally gets that Trump really means business. You know, for example, we don't want to tariff the Indians. I mean, we want to do a trade deal with the Indians. They're one of our most important strategic partners in the Pacific. So what do the Russians think when Trump is saying, look, I am willing to punish the Indians to send you the message that I am serious here? And then there's the arms flows and stuff. So I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that Trump is really serious. And now we'll find out if Putin is. And I think the president just, you know, like this guy, only this guy can do, really just kind of put the icing on it. But when he said, okay, yeah, I will meet with you after you meet with Zelensky. Hmm. Which I think is just kind of genius, because that really boxes Putin in. Because if he meets with Zelensky and Zelensky says, well, you know, the guy was a dork, then Trump will say, well, forget it. He's just trying to play me. So he's really kind of put Putin in the spot. And Putin does not have a lot of cards to play. His choices are to fight a war that he literally can never win. Now, to be honest, I don't think there's anything we can do with sanctions to force him to stop fighting if he doesn't want to. But he is winning a war that he can never win. You know, now they say that, you know, at the rate they're going to take him 100 years to conquer Ukraine. And in 100 years, they'll be saying it's going to take him 100 years to conquer Ukraine. Now, there are reports that the Russians are saying, look, just play for time, that we think we can win this war in 3 months. I think that's delusional. I don't know if Putin believes that or not. I will tell you that if he is not honest about coming to the table and doing a straight-out ceasefire, that he is going to get the wrath of the Trumpster on him.
Yeah, and it's quite clear that President Trump has become increasingly frustrated with Putin. He continues to employ those drone strikes in the cities and hitting civilian targets and so forth, war crimes. And you mentioned the idea of more sanctions on Russia, but is there anything, hasn't the Russian economy kind of, you know, weaned itself off of whatever America can do to it?
No, I mean, no, I think there's still a lot more pain that can be delivered to him. But I don't know if you can necessarily ever do enough to force him to stop fighting. Because, you know, remember, look at North Korea. North Korea is the most sanctioned country on the planet.
Right.
They're isolated. They are very poor. But yet they have the most advanced nuclear weapons program on the planet. Mm. The Iranians keep going. You can be a heavily sanctioned country. And as long as you're a dictatorship, look at Venezuela, and you control everything, you can make sure that in the end, no matter how little money is coming in, that the money you need for your stuff gets funded. And remember, Putin sets the pace of the war. If he doesn't have resources, he can slow down. You can't force him to stop, but you can make life a lot more painful for him. And the choices are, he can find an endless war that he never wins, or he can work from a ceasefire and go from there.
They've taken just an awful toll on, well, both Ukraine and Russia, but Russia's military has just gotten beat to smithereens.
It has, and they keep saying, well, we're going to rebuild. But where's the money coming? Where are the money? Where's the resources and everything else coming from that? Well, and look what they're doing now. And, you know, to this is, you know, increasingly the Chinese are getting a lot of anger and pushback and from their support for Putin. Now the Indians are going to are feeling pain for this. So their friends are going like, "Hey, dude, you're not helping us out."
Yeah.
And what they're saying, this is the other thing, is yeah, the Chinese are happy to keep the Russians in the war, but what they're finding is it's not weakening America, and it's actually not weakening Europe. It's having the opposite effect. It's making the NATO front stronger. It's making the U.S. president more aggressive. And so rather than kind of distracting and weakening Donald Trump, the support for the war in Russia is actually has not played out well for the Chinese, other than they get cheap oil and stuff like that.
And that's about it. Yeah. And where do the people come from? Because if you're going to take ground, and Russia's taking some ground in Ukraine, clearly.
Right.
But you can't do that with drone strikes. That takes people.
No.
And where are the people? At some point, don't you run out of dudes?
Yeah, the rate of life per foot that they are paying for to conquer a ground in Ukraine is on the scale of kind of like World War One scale. I mean, it's just in the many thousands to gain inches of ground. And remember, in some places they're losing ground to the Ukrainians. So it's not a winnable war. Okay, I don't look. Anybody that tells you this is what Putin is thinking, I don't believe any of these people. I don't think anybody knows about Putin. But you know, when they say, "Well, the generals keep telling them they can win this war in 3 months," I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if he believes it or not.
Well, they thought they were going to do it in 2 weeks. They thought they were going to do it in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I think it's very clear that there. You remember Vietnam? The reason why we never won the war in Vietnam is we always refused to actually invade Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they could always turn in and get resources from the Russians and the Chinese, so they could fight on forever. It's kind of the same way here. You know, we're going to support the Ukrainians. Okay, the Chinese are going to support the Russians. But neither one of us are going to come in on the side of either of these guys to fight. And when Trump is in such a strong position, because he has crafted for the Americans a responsible position that all Americans are behind, I'm going to support them. I'm not going to abandon them. But, you know, we're not going to put American boots on the ground. We're not going to get involved in this war. And Americans are like, cool.
Yeah. No,
so short of actually physically interfering in the war, Americans say, do whatever you want. That's a lot.
Yeah. And it's a winning position for the president. We're visiting with Jim Carafano, senior foreign policy fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Before we let you go, Jim, what do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu today saying he wants to fully occupy the whole of the Gaza Strip temporarily? How does that strike you?
I make it, it's like, what other options do we have? There's clearly only one path forward. The new Israelis and the United States have to take over the humanitarian mission in Gaza and run it themselves, excluding the UN and everything else. And Hamas has to have no future governance role in the region at all. There's no other path forward, period. So, yeah, that's what it's going to take.
What does Hamas?
What
does Hamas look like going forward?
Remember, it's like, you know, one of those things where you can buy a company for 5 cents because there's nothing left but the brand name.
Yeah,
I think that'll be Hamas, because if the Iranians are basically decimated and they can't support you. Right. Nobody else is going to put their neck out for you. And the people of Gaza say, thanks a lot for, you know, destroying our land. We really appreciate that. I think Hamas becomes irrelevant. I think it's a thing that exists in name only. And then you watch, because then Donald Trump will start going to the Qataris and other people and say, hey, those Hamas guys that are living in high rises, they got to leave.
Yeah.
And so so they'll all be living they will be living in Tehran.
Do you find it as interesting as I do that Hezbollah was active early on in this thing, and they've kind of disappeared?
The government in Lebanon just declared that Hezbollah had a disarm.
Wow.
I mean, that's where we are. I mean, it's the transformation that has happened in 6 months in the Middle East is beyond stunning. It's like if we took World War II and we compressed it down into 6 months. If they bombed us on December 6th, and by June we were landing in Normandy, that's the pace of change that we've seen in the Middle East.
It's been absolutely overwhelming, and Netanyahu said he was going to bring overwhelming force to bear, and he has, and so it continues. Last thing, just going back to this Trump-Putin, what do you think the odds are that the two of them actually do sit down face-to-face in the next couple of weeks?
I can go either way on this. But yeah, actually, I was thinking, trying to think out how to articulate this. But this is, Donald Trump has managed to put himself now increasingly in foreign policy situations where the choices are he wins or he wins. Where he doesn't lose, right? So, like, when it came, should he bomb Iran? I was like, I don't care. If he bombs Iran, it's going to be successful. We're going to win. If he doesn't bomb Iran, the Iranians are going to bomb Iran, and we're going to be, and the Israelis are going to bomb Iran, we're going to be winning. And so now it's like, if Putin comes to the table and make a deal, we're going to win. If Putin doesn't come to the table, we're going to support the Ukrainians, and the Russians are going to lose.
There he is. Jim, I really... really appreciate your time this afternoon and your insight, as always, spot on. We're grateful to have you. That's Jim Carafano, Senior Policy Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk to you down the road, my friend. And he's gone. So we're going to step aside. When we come back, another bit of breaking news today, other than the fact Mark Reardon is coming back tomorrow on the Mark Reardon Show. State Senator Brian Williams from North St. Louis County, he's a Democrat, he announced today for St. Louis County Executive to oppose Dr. Sam Page in the August primary next year. We'll talk to Brian Williams next on 97.1 FM Talk. Hey there, it's the Mark Reardon program. John Hancock sitting in. Mark Reardon will be back in this chair, in this studio tomorrow, taking the reins, having a Reardon roundtable on a Friday afternoon. And earlier this afternoon, some news was made out in St. Louis County. State Senator Brian Williams, he represents Missouri's 14th Senate District in North St. Louis County, made the announcement today. He's a Democrat. He is filing as a Democrat for county executive against the now indicted Sam Page. Anybody that's listened to me much over the last, 6 years, wow, seems like it's been forever that this guy, I'm not a particular fan of Dr. Page, and he's a guy that just can't get along with people.
No.
And I've never seen anybody alienate their own party like this guy has. Now, Brian Williams gets into the race. He's a known commodity. He's a state senator, and he's been there for a while. And he joins us right now on 97.1. Senator, welcome aboard. Do we have him?
Thanks,
oh, there he is. All right. I'm a little worried about the cell connection there, Senator, but we're going to give it a go. So you announced today, presumably you're going to be running against Sam Page, although who knows what his future holds. But what is it that you're running on?
Well, first, John, I was listening to you, and I'm actually right over here in Olivet, Missouri. So my district is not just North St. Louis County. I take in the central corridor of St. Louis County as well, communities like Ladue, Olivet, and University City, where I live. And we do go through North County, so I want to make sure nobody gets left out. My reason for getting into this race is pretty simple. I've built a record of working with people from all over our entire state to get real results for St. Louis County and our region. And that's something that I've taken great pride in over the years serving in the Missouri Senate. And I'm really confident that we'll be able to make a case to voters next August on how we can move the county forward and get people really moving in the right direction around bold results and delivering services that make everyone want to sleep, eat, and work here.
Would you define yourself as a more of a collaborative leader?
Well, I define myself exactly like every other St. Louis County resident. They get up and they work with people they may like or they may not like, and they still have to do their job at a high level. And that's how I've treated my career the entire time. Even if I disagree with you, I have a duty to our state and most importantly to St. Louis County residents to deliver for them. And that's what I've done for the past 7 years.
Well, and it's really interesting because you're serving now in the Missouri State Senate. And I think it's accurate to say you're one of the more liked Democrats by the Republican majority in the Missouri State Senate. And you focused a lot of your effort over the years on job creation and economic development. Talk about that.
Well, first, ensuring that our region is safe, we're creating jobs, we're building a workforce of tomorrow. And most importantly, we're making sure that people understand that the St. Louis region makes up 45% of the GDP, meaning the St. Louis region, whether that includes St. Charles County, Jefferson County, Franklin County, and the city of St. Louis, makes up majority of the economy. And when that region is doing well, John, the entire state of Missouri does well. And that's the case I've made to my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, and they get it. And it's been something that's helped me bring a lot of resources back to the region. And I'm looking forward to working with local leaders here to come together and continue to make that case here in St. Louis County.
One of the things that you have focused on and successfully executed is getting $23 million for a new state-of-the-art public safety facility and police intelligence center located in St. Louis County. Are you a Democrat who describes himself as defund the police? It doesn't look like it.
No, I'm proud of my relationship with law enforcement, and I always refer back to one of my heroes, my uncle. He was a police officer here in the St. Louis region for 27 years. And if you notice, 27 years is a very odd number. It's not 25 and it's not 30. And that's simply because my family made him pretty much retire because they felt it was a dangerous job and worried whether or not he'll make it home at night. It's a very high-stress job, and it's not lost upon me that it's a job that deserves to have the tools to be able to not only build the trust, but ensure that officers are being safe and we're growing what I believe is an honorable profession. I don't think that's a partisan issue, and I think it should be a common goal to keep families safe, and that's something I plan to do in St. Louis County.
So you're looking ahead, and right now, Sam Page has announced as a Democrat for the reelection. Dennis Hancock, no relation, has announced as a Republican for the Republican Party nomination. But you're facing off against Sam Page. And what do you see as the bigger contrast between a Brian Williams as county executive versus a continuation of the Sam Page era?
I don't think it's really about a comparison. I think it's simply on my record. I've taken bold ideas and I've turned them into real results. And I've been able to work with people and build coalitions that allow us to take our region forward. And that's exactly what I plan to do as St. Louis County Executive. I think the days of divisive government and focusing on the negative things, not advancing our region around issues that mean things to St. Louis residents, is over. And I plan to bring that energy. I plan to bring my record of service. And most importantly, I plan to bring my ability to collaborate and partner and have a government that's all rowing in the same direction for the same cause.
You know, one of the things, because I'm a county resident, I'll be voting in this election, and one of the things that was noteworthy about St. Louis County government for my entire adult life was it was stable. Not a lot of drama. It ran efficiently. Its books were balanced, and that was true whether the county executive was a Republican like Gene McNary or a Democrat like Buzz Westfall. There just wasn't a lot of drama in the county. Might we see a return to those days?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's important that there's stability, and I think that it's important that we have a government that functions for St. Louis residents. And right now, we've seen more circumstances where the government is having a hard time working together than actually working for St. Louis County residents. And I think having that stable government, and we've seen previous executives carry that attitude of having smart people around them that can help the government go forward, and
Bingo.
That's what I plan to do as well.
Bingo. That's a really excellent point. You know, strong leaders surround themselves by strong people. Weak leaders surround themselves by folks that, frankly, aren't very good. And I think that's a big distinction to be made. Before I let you scoot on down the road here, there's a problem in the county in terms of the budget. This budget has had a very hard time being balanced. Do you have any thoughts on how that ought to be addressed? That's not happening now.
Yeah, absolutely. I've served on the Missouri Senate Appropriations Committee for majority of my career. And every year, not only did we balance a budget, but we ensured that we wasn't in a deficit. And I plan to, one, clearly assess the state budget, sit down with smart people, figure out where some opportunities for us to save money, but most importantly, where are opportunities for us to generate revenue. And that'll be something that I'll be laser focused on. And it's something that's very, very deeply concerning and something that residents should keep at the top of their mind when they think about who should lead this county next year.
Folks, the indicted Sam Page is no longer unopposed in the Democratic primary for St. Louis County Executive. He has been enjoined into that effort by State Senator Brian Williams. Senator Williams, thanks so much for your time today on the day you announced for office, and I wish you the best.
Hey, John, thanks for having me, and look forward to seeing you guys soon.
All right, that's Brian Williams. Sue, you know, we were talking before the interview just how dysfunctional St. Louis County has become.
It's outrageous.
You had Steve Stenger get indicted, go to jail. Now Sam Page has been indicted. I don't know, certainly in my lifetime, that there's ever been a county executive indicted before.
Nope.
In St. Louis County. I mean, it's just bizarroville.
Agreed.
And I don't know if Brian Williams will be the only challenger to Sam Page. Heck, I don't even know if Sam Page is going to run. I don't even know if he may be convicted.
If he's allowed to. Yeah, I don't know.
So, you know, he's been charged with two misdemeanors and two felonies. And the felonies relate to the use of public funds to send a mailing out. I don't want to get into the details of all of that. I suspect, and Page has hired pretty good legal counsel, Jeff Jensen, the former U.S. attorney. I think they're probably, if I had to guess, they're going to plead that down to the misdemeanors. That will allow Sam Page to keep his medical license.
Yeah.
And he will agree to step aside. That's how I think this is going to play out.
It's a good bet.
But it's hard to say. Well, we need to step aside for a little bit. We got some news coming up. Next hour, lots to do. I'm going to tell Sue about the joys of being a grandpa.
Love it.
That's next on 97.1 FM Talk.